Coming up, Fred the Sam Lazaro reports on violence in India between Hindus who consider cows sacred and Muslims who eat beef. And Lucky Severson looks at grieving on social media. Plus, World Hijab Day, an event to help non-Muslim women understand what it's like to wear the traditional Muslim head covering.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. And many thanks to those who filled in for me over the last several weeks. Religious freedom activists are expressing relief that Christian pastor Saeed Abedini was released from an Iranian prison. He was among four Americans freed in Iran last weekend as part of a prisoner swap. His wife, Nagma, had waged a high-profile campaign on his behalf. Abedini had traveled to Iran to establish home churches and an orphanage. He was sentenced to 8 years in prison in 2013 after Iranian authorities said he had compromised national security. Nagma said the family now needs time to heal. A new report from the United Nations says nearly 19,000 Iraqi civilians have died and more than 3 million have fled their homes over a 22-month period. Fighting among the terrorist group ISIS, Iraq security forces, and pro-government militias led to the high death toll. The report also estimates that ISIS is holding approximately 3,500 Iraqis as slaves, mostly women and children from the country's Yazidi religious minority, some of whom are being sold as sex slaves. Italy's Muslim community has invited Pope Francis to visit Rome's Great Mosque. Although Pope Francis has visited several mosques, this would be the first time that a pope visits the Great Mosque in Rome. The invitation came on the heels of the pope's visit last weekend to Rome's Great Synagogue, where he condemned violence in the name of religion and stressed interfaith relationships. The pontiff's visit came half a century after Nostra Aetate, a landmark Vatican document that opened the way for Catholic-Jewish dialogue. Religious groups are responding to the water contamination crisis in Flint, Michigan by raising money and distributing supplies. The Michigan Muslim Community Council has distributed more than 120,000 bottles of clean water. Catholic Charities is also giving out water and food, and the Flint Jewish Federation is collecting water and water filters. President Obama has declared the situation in Flint a federal state of emergency. The Supreme Court announced this week that it will hear a legal challenge to President Obama's attempt at immigration reform. In 2014, Obama introduced a program intended to allow as many as 5 million illegal immigrants to remain in the country, either parents of U.S. citizens or of those who have permanent resident status. Religious groups that have condemned the deportations of families welcomed the announcement by the court and said they were praying for justice. The case was brought by a coalition of 26 states that opposed the president's initiative. The Supreme Court has also agreed to hear a case that could have major implications for religious schools. The case involves a Lutheran preschool in Missouri that was denied state aid. The Association of Christian Schools International has argued that the government discriminated against the school by denying it public benefits. This week marked the 43rd anniversary of the court's Roe v. Wade decision legalizing abortion nationwide. Abortion opponents held several events, In addition to the annual March for Life, many evangelical leaders gathered in Washington to discuss how to revive the grassroots pro-life movement. India's history is punctuated by spasms of religious violence. The more recent incidents have been over the alleged consumption of beef by Muslims and others, an age-old controversy that traces back to the Hindu belief that cows are sacred. Fred DeSam-Lazaro reports.
Last October, in a village not far from India's capital, a 56-year-old Muslim man was beaten to death and his son gravely injured by an allegedly Hindu mob. His alleged crime? A rumor that he'd butchered a cow, an animal considered sacred to Hindus. Muhammad Akhlaq's home was ransacked, including the contents of the refrigerator, before the police arrived.
A person has been killed because there were allegations that...
It was perhaps the most egregious in a spate of recent such incidents widely reported in the media. They have alarmed many in India's liberal political establishment and especially leaders of the significant Muslim minority who fear a rising intolerance in this largely Hindu nation.
The psyche that spawns an incident like this is against India's secularism and brotherhood. It is thinking that looks down upon Muslims with distrust. This incident was not triggered by the beef issue. They murdered him on religious grounds.
Whatever triggered the incident, the beef issue has been a political hot potato, one that's endured even as the country has entered the globalized economy. You won't find beef in a Burger King anywhere in India, for example, or a McDonald's. Here, burgers come from sheep, chickens, even vegetables, but not cows. Paradoxically, the animals roam freely on the street, vulnerable to poisonous garbage and to being captured and taken to slaughter at night, though there are efforts to crack down on that illegal practice and to herd cows into shelters.
We don't even believe that the cow is an animal. We see it as a manifestation of God. Our magazine tries to educate people about the mother cow, about the benefits of the cow.
Hindus, 80% of India's 1.2 billion people, have long venerated the cow. It is the favorite animal of the deity Lord Krishna, and that reverence in turn is likely linked to the animal's utility. Devinder Nayak edits a magazine dedicated to improving awareness of the cow's significance.
A poor family can sustain themselves with just one family of cows. They can sell the milk, use the dung and the urine, which has many medicinal properties.
Whether that reverence should mean an outright ban on beef has been a vexing issue ever since independence in 1947 from the beef-loving British rulers. The father of modern India, a Hindu, professed his love for the cow, but Mahatma Gandhi said he would not impose his views on Muslims, Christians, as well as Hindus in some regions who do consume beef. Nonetheless, India's constitution, while not outlawing cow slaughter, urges individual states to do so.
Now, India is a federal country, and so many states have in fact gone ahead and outright banned cow slaughter.
Shashi Tharoor is an author and member of the opposition Congress, the once powerful party of Gandhi and Nehru. For years under Congress rule, there was an accommodation of beef consumption in minority and many urban communities. But that changed with the election in 2014 of a Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, led by charismatic Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
The BJP has essentially encouraged a more proactive and aggressive form of Hindu chauvinism, as a result of which the authorities' zeal in voicing public disapproval of beef eating has suddenly created political tensions in our society. That's the sort of polarization that could be deeply damaging to India's stability and India's future, and what many of us who are not particularly fond of beef still rail against. I'm a vegetarian myself.
In a recent speech in Parliament, Tharoor said the frequent reports of vigilante groups targeting minorities, of rising intolerance, is coming at the cost of India's reputation.
A Bangladeshi friend of mine was visiting Delhi that week, and he told me that Islamic fundamentalists in his country were having a field day attacking India as a place where it's safer to be a cow than a Muslim.
Is that a bit of hyperbole?
It is a bit of hyperbole. It was a line I used in a speech in Parliament, to good effect, I'm pleased to say. But at the same time, I should stress that obviously it's not meant to be taken literally. What I wanted people on the ruling party's benches to realize is that it's their conduct that has enabled critics of India to say things like this. And I think that it's high time that the government realized that they're making asses of themselves and discrediting an enormously plural and diverse civilization.
For his part, Prime Minister Modi, though allied with Hindu nationalist groups, has not involved himself in their key demand that India declare itself a Hindu nation. Modi has stuck to the pro-business economic development theme he struck ever since ascending to office.
Hindus, decide if you want to fight against Muslims or fight against poverty. Muslims, decide whether you want to fight against Hindus or against poverty. Our country can only prosper if Hindus and Muslims unite to fight against poverty and we defeat poverty.
Coming several days after the murder of Muhammad Akhlaq, Modi was criticized for saying too little, too late, and for not reining in vigilante groups and some members of his party who made statements appearing to support them. It turns out, by the way, that the meat found in Akhlaq's refrigerator was not beef, but mutton. But Modi's supporters say it is the opposition that is using divisive religious politics for their own gain.
The Prime Minister has repeatedly said that if the country should remain united, everyone will have to walk hand in hand for development. But there are certain politicians that promote pseudo-secularism and are not ready to hear his message.
The key question is whether the so-called beef issue represents the normal ebb and flow of a vibrant, if sometimes violent, democracy, or whether that democracy in fact faces a new real threat. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSamlazaro in New Delhi.
After the recent Paris terrorist attacks, the world took to Twitter using the hashtag #PrayForParis. Others turned to Facebook to write messages of support. Many of those mourning used other social media tools to express sorrow. From YouTube to Snapchat, Lucky Severson reports on how social media has created a new space to grieve.
Grieving is a universal experience. Virtually every sane human from time immemorial has suffered personal pain when loved ones die. It may seem unlikely for some, but for others, social media provides comfort and it matters. Within hours of the recent Paris terrorist attacks, Twitter, using the hashtag #PrayForParis, recorded 6.7 million posts. Facebook pages were suddenly awash with friends cloaked in the French flags red, white, and blue. France knew it wasn't grieving alone.
So cyberspace just gives us a new place to grieve, a new place to create rituals, a new place to memorialize the death of someone we care about.
Carla Sofka is a professor of social work at Siena College in Albany, New York, and co-author of a book, Dying, Death, and Grief in an Online Universe. She says our earliest ancestors displayed their grieving on rock walls, so it shouldn't come as a surprise that in 2015, the world shares its pain on the social media wall.
That sense that people are thinking about you and caring about you online is powerful, and I've had people tell me that they thrive on that. They know that there are always people who are thinking about them and that care. It's overwhelming sometimes for people, that sense of support that can be created online.
She went to a theater to see a movie and was killed.
Sandy and Lonnie Phillips will never forget the phone call the night of the Aurora Theater shootings in Colorado from the friend of their daughter, Jesse.
And I said, "Are you okay?" And he said, "I think I've been hit twice." And I'm thinking to myself as he's telling me this, "Where's Jesse?" And I said, "Where's Jesse?" And he said, "I'm sorry." And I said, "Is she okay?" And he said, "I'm sorry, I tried." And I said, "Brent, tell me she's all right." And he couldn't. And at that point, evidently, I started screaming.
Jesse was one of the first victims identified in the aftermath.
I do remember the first time I went back onto Facebook, and all of a sudden there were all these people saying how sorry they were and, you know, that kind of thing. But I didn't realize the power of social media at that point.
I got active on social media, but nothing like Sandy. She just, she spends a lot of time on it. It comforts her.
I remember her friends coming out for her service from Colorado to Texas and sitting down with me and showing me things on Twitter and showing me things on her Facebook page. And that's when I first began to realize, wow, this is huge, how people reach out to one another through social media.
Beyond Facebook, there are many more social media tools, some surprising.
Some people are sending direct messages to the person who has died using their Twitter feed. Snapchat, you can send pictures instantly. YouTube, you can create memorial videos for someone in remembrance of them.
Roger Lindbergh, a television production executive, is one of millions who have turned to Facebook to share their private grief. He retired early so he could take care of his wife, Bonnie, who was dying from a rare lung disease.
The Facebooking definitely was comforting for her. And she kept up very regularly with everybody. I mean, she would post things from the hospital. She would, post pictures of the kids and stuff like that and always be talking.
Bonnie had contacted friends she hadn't talked to in 40 years. And now, a year and a half after her death, those friends are still in touch with Roger, who is convinced his interaction on Facebook helped him with his grief.
I think that made a difference in helping me understand that what I'm going through, what I'm feeling, I'm not alone, and there is a future. Because when something like that happens, you feel like, you know, what is the future? Where do I go from here?
Sitting across from a computer, or even just having the text on a screen, which is what we see, you know, in Facebook or whatever, that gives us the idea of connection, but it's anything but connection.
Jamie Sarchet works for a funeral home that she says performs a majority of the Jewish funerals in the Denver area. She is not a convert to grieving on social media.
You know, it's such an interesting thing that we're in right now. We are so busy online, but we are not connected to people in person. And I think that that online media stuff gives us the shell of connection. It's like, it's a cardboard cutout of connection. It's not real connection.
I have to respect the people who have come to appreciate face-to-face contact, and they want that interpersonal connection. But I also have to respect the fact that young people who've never experienced a life without this technology view it very differently than I do. And if people in my generation are not teaching their kids how to do it in person, smartphones, technology may be the only way these young people have to express their feelings and their thoughts.
So I use Facebook to talk about kind of my pain, what I was going through at the time and how difficult things were, but also for a source of encouragement the other way for my friends and family.
Marcus Weaver works at two charitable foundations in Denver helping low-income families. He had lots of friends on Facebook before the Aurora shootings.
I still see the gunmen, the smoke going across the theater as he came into the theater. I see the silhouette of the gunman through the smoke and his outfit of Kevlar that he had on, and the sound that, you know, I never escaped out of my mind is the shots of the AR-15 gun just repeatedly going off, and, you know, and Rebecca not moving.
His friend Rebecca was killed instantly. Marcus was shot in the arm. He received thousands of messages on Facebook, many from fellow evangelicals.
When I surrounded myself by, you know, people on Facebook who wore prayer warriors. And so there's a lot of people came out of nowhere. I probably wouldn't be sitting here today in front of you if it wasn't for those prayers.
There is a downside to putting your life out there on social media. It's called trolling.
Trolling is a phenomenon where you have someone who is going onto a memorial site, probably not with good intentions.
You know, the trolls have been after us since the very beginning. You know, I remember early on somebody posting something to me about, too bad you weren't in the theater with her. Other people who have said cruel things that, you know, my daughter's still alive and living in the Bahamas and we're rich and have been paid off by the government. And I mean, crazy, really crazy things.
Many seem to agree that media can aid in the therapy of grieving, but that it's often not enough.
Social media can alleviate some of the pain, but it can really take the place of a therapist in a situation that's as horrific as losing a child.
As with much of social media, the future is already present. Cemeteries, for instance, it's now possible to learn more about the deceased when that iconic QR barcode embedded in a headstone is scanned with a smartphone. And there's more, explained by a new phrase called physically dead and virtually alive.
So technology is limitless, and as long as people get creative and think about ways to do this, I have no way of knowing exactly what all will be done to preserve somebody, to immortalize somebody digitally.
Sofka says that although some parts may be troubling or scary, she sees far more advantages and drawbacks in this seemingly limitless technology that enables us to share our grief on social media. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson, Albany, New York.
February 1st has been designated as annual World Hijab Day, designed to foster religious sensitivity and tolerance. The event encourages non-Muslim women for one day to don the headscarf traditionally worn by Muslim women. We visited Umanda Veera Singha, who is Buddhist, as she took the hijab challenge last year in Rockville, Maryland. She was accompanied by her friend, Sophia Amir, who is Muslim.
My friends, a lot of my friends are Muslim, and I admire that they're wearing the scarf.
I'm very religious Muslim. I wear it every day throughout my day. I actually started wearing it as soon as I started college.
I remember looking it up online for February 1st, and I was like, I'm definitely doing this.
When she told me that, you know, she's gonna wear the headscarf for a day, and I thought that it would be impossible.
So my religious background is actually Buddhist. So my mom and my dad are both Buddhist. My entire family is. We also pray to Hindu gods as well. I've not worn a hijab previously, so this would be my first time wearing it.
I actually gave her my scarf. I let her borrow it, and she loved it.
So she needed to help me assemble it, because if I was gonna wear a scarf, I'd just be like. And they do it so precisely. They wrap it around once, they make sure it's neat, then wrap it around again and pin it. So it kept coming off, and she helped me wear it. It's interesting to just walk around, and it's weird because you don't feel the breeze on your hair. You don't feel cold. But it's nice to just wear it, and people will look at you and you'll just smile, and they won't even know if you're Muslim or not because they're not sure of you. A lot of people looked at me like, oh wow, nice scarf. Going around, it just felt so natural to look at other people and just act like it was a normal day. By wearing a scarf, it's like, Amanda, you know you've become a totally different person because it doesn't look like me. Your hair shows a different side of you. Covering it, it can either make your self-esteem low or make your self-esteem high. And for me, it just made me feel more confident. A headscarf isn't meant to hurt you. It's what's meant to protect you. You're modest in the sense of God looking at you, but you're modest to other people as well. You don't let them see a side of you that most people generally see every day. I'm happy with my own faith. I think Islam has its own rules and what people practice. And I admire the religion. I can get a good perspective and outlook on it. But I do like my faith. I like my faith in the sense that it gives me the freedom to do what I want to do. It allows me to even wear the hijab without feeling controversial. My culture is very open. My religion's very open. And it's like if you have to explore new possibilities to get a new perspective, then do it.
I asked her, I was like, what is the reaction? How did you feel? And she said, no, it's really normal. And
I like the scarf. It feels so natural. And I don't know why it does. I feel like it's me.
Finally, on our calendar this week, the Jewish holiday of Tu B'Shvat, the festival celebrating a new year for trees and spring in Israel. And Mahayana Buddhists celebrate the new year. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, the group Sweet Honey in the Rock sings Somebody Prayed for Me from its newly released CD.
I'm so glad they prayed for me. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.